Today is Wednesday, February 10th, 2021. This is part 4 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Nancy Eileen, E-I-L-E-E-N, Muleady-Meacham, M-U-L-E-A-D-Y-M-E-C-H-A-M. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Nancy. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you, Tom.
Great. Nancy, you and I were just talking about where we left off in part 3, and if I get this right, in 1980 and 81, you were in Death Valley. Is that right?
Right, and I was there from October to April, and then from May to October of 81 in Sequoia National Park, and then 81 and 82 and back in Death Valley, and again in the summer of 82 back in Sequoia National Park. And as I went back and forth, I worked as a naturalist, but I also had a background as an emergency medical technician and gave walks, talks, and evening programs. And I believe I talked about how Larry Norris and myself kind of took over the interpretation when we lost the permanent employees, one of which transferred, and the chief had a heart attack.
So that's right.
We did a day in Death Valley, and we had a lot of fun times being innovative. And I would do things called Ties to the Past, which was about the railroad history. We talked about doing Juliet Breyer, Living History, and all kinds of fun things. But one of the things that happened at Death Valley is, especially in after hours in the evenings, I would often get called to respond to emergency medical calls, because it wasn't a requirement back then that all of the protection rangers be EMTs.
Okay.
And so they were few and far between. And it was very frustrating because of the average population there in the wintertime was, you know, 70 to 80. And it was the older people who were snowbirds, basically, and they would come and stay for weeks and weeks at a time and then leave and then come back. So we had heart attacks, we had strokes, and I've written several of these stories in my books, Park Ranger and Park Ranger Sequel, about people having heart attacks during the 49er weeks and trying to bring them back. And it was frustrating for me at these early stage in my life to only be able to do CPR for these people and an airway and not have the ability to do any advanced life support or cardiac support. So with that frustration in mind, I applied and was accepted to paramedic school at Stanford University Hospital. And I started there in summer of 82, and my boss at Sequoia National Park, Bill Tweed, was kind enough to fix it so I could work long hours, like 3 or 4 days a week, and then bomb off to the Bay Area and go to school. That particular paramedic school does not exist at Stanford anymore. It was one of the very first schools in California, and it soon was able to segue to one of the community colleges, and Stanford moved on to other things. But it was kind of neat to go there, and with housing being just so awful right now, I actually got a room in an old Victorian house on 200 Emerson Street. I think it was 200 Emerson Street. Anyway, for just a couple hundred dollars a month, but it was just, you know, kitchen privileges and bathroom. But it was an adventurous time for a young person.
In that Stanford paramedic school, do you remember who else was in there? I mean, what did people coming from different areas? Was there anybody else in the Park Service there?
No. This is strictly a civilian run thing. I did this all on my own, and I paid for it on my own, except for one thing. I got an envelope addressed to me, and there was no return address, and inside was a $100 bill.
Wow.
And a little note said, an investment in the life of a good person.
Wow.
And I had no idea, and I went to two or three people that I thought might have done it, and I said, thank you, and they said, for what? And I said, for this, and they said, I didn't do that. So they either denied it or I didn't find the person to thank. But that was one of the a very nice thing that somebody did for me at that time.
That's really wonderful.
$100 may not seem like much, but the tuition for that class was $1,000. So that helped a lot.
Right. I mean, that's 40 years ago. That was a big chunk of that was a good chunk of money back then. Who else was in the class? Were they simply people that wanted to become EMTs to be?
No. These are people becoming paramedics.
Thank you.
You're already EMTs.
Thank you.
And these are people who are hoping to work for an ambulance company.
Okay.
Maybe to get on with the fire department. This was so early that when I became a paramedic and worked in Modesto, the fire department in Modesto still did not respond to medical calls. That was not in their purview. Now that's what they do. You know, that's 80% of their calls. And the fire chief was so old-fashioned that he would only go and help extricate people, but they wouldn't do patient care. So when I was in Modesto, it was so early in being a paramedic back then that we had all standing orders. We did some very advanced life support things.
Like what?
Pericardiocentesis is one. We were able to go underneath the xiphoid bone of the sternum and go into the cardiac covering around the heart and pull out blood with a syringe.
Okay.
You don't do that now. A surgeon does that now. And so many other things that, and all of our calls were standing orders. You go to another county and you can't even start an IV without permission from the base station. But Modesto was very early and progressive in that we did endotracheal intubations, surgical cricothyrotomies. We did a lot of stuff that I was able to do for years, actually.
Okay.
Some of the other things probably, I mean, we stopped short of cesarean sections, but they talked about that, emergency C-sections in the field. So
okay.
It was early on for sure. And then I worked, as I said, from Modesto Sirius Ambulance, which later became 911 Ambulance, which later became, I think, I'll have to think about the name that they are today, but they've changed hands many times. So in the wintertime, I would often work as a paramedic in a city, and then I would work as a naturalist at Sequoia National Park, and I did that up until December of 1983. So at that time, I would be working as a city paramedic and get lots and lots of calls, averaging, 10, 12 calls sometimes a day, maybe fewer. But that might be what a park medic would get in an entire season.
Right, right.
At Sequoia or Death Valley or Tetons or wherever they were.
So just kind of clarifying this, you had been alternating between a seasonal at Death Valley in the winter and Sequoia in the summer. And,
right.
And so what you did is replaced that winter in Death Valley with the paramedic school and then moving on to working for the Modesto Ambulance.
Right. But that changed in December of 1983 when I applied and received an appointment as a park ranger in Everglades.
Okay.
So now I'm back to working, and then I would work, sometimes I'd work the winter park for a few months, then I'd work at the city paramedic. So I have a whole thing. So I worked at 83, 84, I worked in Everglades National Park, April to October, Sequoia National Park, from 84 to 85 to the Arizona Memorial. And then I took another big step in a career choice. And from December to April, I went to the Santa Cruz Criminal Justice Training Center as a law enforcement student. And this was, I had seen the writing on the wall. If I wanted to be a naturalist, I didn't really have to do anything. If I wanted to continue in emergency medicine, I'd have to become a protection ranger.
Okay, this is really helpful, Nancy, because I remember... and I apologize, I've lost a page of my notes. In part three, we talked about your time at the Everglades. And you had a friend there, and we talked about crocodiles.
Right, right.
But I don't think we talked about the Arizona Memorial in Hawaii.
No, and that was very exciting. That was before 9/11, before all of the big changes.
Okay.
And Hawaii, as it turned out, was an incredible experience, but a very expensive experience. And so I was.
Why did you choose Hawaii?
It was one that you have only a handful. You have, at that time, maybe 380 national park areas, of which maybe only 10 of them are considered, quote, winter parks.
Okay.
So everybody hires seasonals in the summer, but if you want to work as a seasonal in the winter,
right,
you went to Everglades, you went to Death Valley, you went to Hawaii, you went to the Virgin Islands, you went to where it was warm,
okay,
in the wintertime. And so I had already been to Death Valley and I'd already been to Everglades, so I just wanted to try something different. And this was a chance to go to Hawaii. I'd never been there before.
Wow.
And were
you looking, with your experience in scuba diving, were you looking to do diving there and to get out, you know?
Oh, yes, to dive for sure, which I did. I dove on a lot of my first wrecks out there.
Wow.
W-R-E-C-K-S. And so when I got there, I remember I arrived in the evening. My flight out there, one way, was $128.
Wow.
And I brought several boxes, my bicycle, which they encouraged me to do, which was an old 1965 bicycle. And,
that didn't fold in half. I bet the baggage people were grumbling down there.
They put it in a bicycle box, and they put it on the plane.
Oh,
back
my gosh.
It was so easy. So easy to do all that stuff. I even had a 6-inch dive knife I just brought as a carry-on.
Oh, my gosh.
Because I didn't want to lose it, you know. So things were so relaxed. There was no metal detectors. People could see you off at the gate. It was very different.
Yeah.
But I got there, and the person who picked me up had a VW bug. So, you know, we crowded my bicycle, tied the bicycle on the top. And he had made arrangements for me to rent a room in one of the permanent rental house. So kind of a sublet.
Okay.
And so it was in a little town called Aiea, A-I-E-A, which is up from Pearl City, which was, I'm trying to remember if it was a 2.5 or 3.5 mile one-way walk to the Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
I ended up not riding my bike to and from work because it was easy downhill, but it was a grunt all the way uphill. We had to go past Aloha Stadium, the C&H Sugar Factory, and all that stuff. So I walked it every day, and it was very delightful, but I had to get up before dawn, and as you did so, they had what they called palmetto bugs. Well, cockroaches.
Okay.
Giant cockroaches there.
Oh.
And you would walk on the sidewalk before the sun would come up, and they would crunch under your feet. It was very sad. But anyway, and I loved the wind. Oh, that's my favorite thing in the whole world. It's like Mother Nature giving you a big old hug.
Mm-hmm.
So the wind would blow, and as I walked by the chain link fence by Pearl Harbor, there would be all these plastic bags caught in, and I'd have my little tape player, and I'd be listening to musicals and, you know, South Pacific and Man of La Mancha and all these different things. I just love that kind of stuff. So I would listen to as I walked to and from work. But I had a room, a very small room, a mattress on the floor, and kitchen privileges. And it was very interesting living in Aiea. I found out that if I walked uphill into a very small enclave there, that there was a laundromat. So I would take my laundry up and do it in the laundromat, and then I'd go down to the place to get something to eat for lunch, and I would stand in line, and I was the only Haole there, and Haole is the slang for a white person there, as opposed to somebody who lived in Hawaii. And when I would get up toward my time in line, it was really disconcerting because the person at the counter would help everybody around me but me, even if though I had worked my way up in line, until there was nobody there to help but me.
Hmm.
So it was my first look at being
discriminated against. Yeah.
And I had, you know, I had sadness for people who were slighted, you know, especially people of color, but I never experienced it myself until then.
Hmm.
And what I had realized as I came back week after week to do my laundry, that it changed. They thought I was some tourist, perhaps, trying to get local color or something.
Ah.
And later on, as they got to know me, knew I lived there and all that kind of stuff, then that never happened again.
Nice.
But it was very interesting. Mm. And because it was so expensive there, if lettuce was a quarter on the mainland, it was $1.25 in Hawaii.
Wow.
So I would go over to the Aloha Stadium parking lot where they had flea markets.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times you could buy cans of food without labels on them. And they said, oh, these are pineapples, these are this. And so I buy some of those for very cheap, you know, like 15 cents a can. I later found out, you know, many years later that it was probably all stolen, but I didn't know that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would buy cheap food, and I made a point to go to every single island. That's what I did with my money.
Oh,
is
wow.
I flew to each of the other islands, and sometimes I went with a friend of mine who I worked with at the Arizona Memorial, and Gail Manami was one of my traveling friends. We
how do you spell Gail's last name?
M-I-N-A-M-I.
Thank you.
She later became the chief ranger at Hawaii Volcanoes, but we went to Kalapaupau. We went down Molokai Cliffs on mules and went to the leper colony when there were still people who had leprosy living there.
And they still let people go out there. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And it was important. Tourism was important for them. It was
okay.
An important part. But it's a national park area.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I would went to each of the islands. Of course, I couldn't afford to do anything but sleep in my car, so I'd have a rental car, and I would drive to somewhere, and then I would spend the night in the car and then go hiking somewhere. And at Maui, I went to Haleakala, and I parked, I'll never forget this, I parked the car at the very top with the intent of hiking all the way down the crater of the Sliding Sands Trail. Then you come out on the one road that goes all the way back up, but it's, you know, it's like a 7-mile walk all
mm-hmm.
the way back up.
Mm-hmm.
So I got all the way down to the road, and I thought, I've never done this before. I'm going to put a finger out, and I'm going to ask for a ride. And just as I was going to do that, this car comes up and says, can you tell us where the parking lot is for Haleakala? And I said, well, I'm headed there myself. You give me a ride, I can point it out to you. Great. So they took me to the top, not realizing it was the one and only road, and they would never get lost. So that was a lot of fun.
Fun.
But there were many, many different guys who worked for the park service there named Mark. So they all had different names. There's Mark, Marco, Aleko, Marque. You know, so we all give them different names because we couldn't have had five Marks there.
Right.
But that was just a coincidence. But Mark Tanaka Sanders was my boss, and he was a neat guy. He was
how do you
Mark
spell
Sanders.
His last name?
Tanaka, T-A-N-A-K-A hyphen Sanders, S-A-N-D-E-R-S.
Okay.
He was my boss. He was originally from the mainland.
Okay.
And he was Howley like me, but he married a local girl, and so together they hyphenated their last name.
Oh, cool.
And the cool thing about that is, you know, I went to places, their house, and because she was Native Hawaiian, I got invited to some real luau's and real ceremonies. And
oh,
real
wow.
I remember at the first real luau I went to, and I'm not a fish food person. I was, actually at that time, I was still eating fish and seafood, but I remember eating octopus and thinking, this tastes and feels just like an octopus. You know? All the suckers and everything, but that's, you know, you did what you did.
Yeah.
And so it was just really, really cool.
Wow.
And I felt very patriotic. I felt very proud to be there at the time. And if I may give a little bit of a observation, I grew up in a family that's very proud. I'm liberal. And I was proud of the flag, and I feel like it's been usurped right now, the American flag, for nefarious means. And it makes me sad that when I see that, sometimes I don't feel the pride I used to feel in it. I feel like somebody's taken it and using it for nefarious means rather than the patriotism it should normally represent.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so the Department of the Navy ran the boats and the National Park Service gave the tours out on the memorial.
Oh, wow. That's an odd sort of memorandum of understanding there.
It is. And so it was a very small thing. It's not the big thing it was now. It had a little bookstore, and you could buy flags that got raised up on the flagpole over the Arizona, which is an arch over the battleship itself, BB-39. And because it was just had been refueled before the bombing at Pearl Harbor, it still has a drop of fuel that comes up every now and then. It makes kind of a flick on the water, and I still got asked the questions, and I was warned I would get asked the question, is that Blood of the Sailors?
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
But they had won a band contest the night before, so they had the right to sleep in the next morning. So a lot of them died in their bunks. That's why 1,179 people. I gave all these statistics, you know, so they're sort of in my brain still.
Yeah.
And then the wall with all that name. So they would, people would come in, and you work the desk, and there would be announcements both in English and in Japanese. And so I could speak a lot of Japanese, but it's only what I had heard like 30,000 times over and over on the loudspeaker.
Right.
You know, I could tell them where the restroom was, but people would start, because half the visitors to the memorial were Japanese.
Wow.
The other half were Americans.
Okay.
Or, you know, people who were not Japanese. And the few things I could say in Japanese, you know, ohayou gozaimasu and a few other things, they would just start to speak Japanese to me, and I go, well, time out, that's it. But we gave out free tickets. The memorial was free.
Okay.
And so we'd give out free tickets, and because we had to limit the number of people on the tour because of the number of people on boats. So once you had a group, you did the introduction to this marvelous movie they had put together, that was shown on big theater cameras, and then projectors, excuse me. And then you would take them out, and then you'd get them on the boat. You'd go over with them, with the sailors, and they were often female sailors that were on the boat. And then they would take them across. We'd get up on the memorial, and we'd tell them before they got on, you know, no talking, no chewing gum. I mean, whisper. You know, be very solemn because we're basically in a graveyard here.
Right.
And when you walked over there, as many times as I did it, you did get a feeling of reverence and respect. And never had to ever tell anybody, even kids, I never had to tell them to quit acting up. You could feel it, I guess.
Mm.
And because then you walk in and there's this whole big wall with all their names on it. And I was privileged enough to be working there on December 7th when they held the big ceremony every year. And I was so fortunate that on this huge day to be assigned to be on the memorial itself. So I went out to the memorial, and Daniel Inouye, who was a senator at the time, and all these congressmen and high-ranking admirals and stuff had come over for the ceremony, and they had what I call echo taps. They had somebody at one end of the memorial go do do do, and the other one would go do do do, and they did taps just back and forth to each other.
Wow!
And then all these ships would go by. I mean, battleships and cruisers and destroyers and stuff. And everybody was in their whites, and they would just go by the memorial one after another, all saluting. And it was just it just gives me goosebumps to think about it. But wow. I got to see all of that. It was very cool.
Oh, God, gosh!
And I got to raise up flags and put them down. And so because I was out on the memorial before everybody came and after everybody left just to be the presence, I put up a flag on December 7th for my parents.
Oh, wow.
And brought it down, you know, bought it in the bookstore, put it up, brought it down, and then I sent it to my mom and dad. And they, that's still part of the family. So that was a fun thing to be able to do.
Cool.
That picture is actually in my book, Park Ranger.
Hmm.
And it was a rainy kind of a day, kind of a gloomy day, but it kind of fit to be that day. But my favorite days at the memorial were Tuesdays. Tuesdays are when the Navy band came and played with their band on the grass in front of the flagpole. So I always volunteered to go out and put up the flag, and it was one of those huge, huge flags that you see over car dealerships sometimes.
Yeah.
A gigantic, so it took two of us to put up the flag. So the band would be all lined up, and we're talking about like 30 people, and they're playing all these songs, and they sound as good as you might think they might sound.
Boy,
they're like 5 feet away. So we would clip it up, and they did it, and it would go up, and they would play, you know, the Star Spangled Banner, and they play America the Beautiful and all that kind of stuff, and the flag would go up, and you'd have hundreds of people just gathering on the grass listening to the Navy band as you put the flag up. I mean, we put this flag up every single day, but on Tuesdays the band came.
Wow.
And that was very special.
Yeah. Huh.
And because I had gone to and received my seasonal commission as a protection ranger, one of the things my added duties was to walk through the parking lot to make sure people didn't break into cars, and nobody ever did. I worked as a paramedic and had a couple calls there at the memorial. One was very sad. I remember specifically her name was Virginia, and she was 72, and she had chest pain, and they called me over, and I said, yeah, we need the ambulance. And as I was doing my patient assessment and asking about her medical history, I said, well, what medications are you on? And she told me, and I said, well, did you take them today? She goes, no, I haven't taken them since we got here. I'm on vacation. I didn't think I needed to.
Oh.
And sadly, she passed away.
Hmm.
So I always teach my students that now. I said, people just don't understand. It's your job to explain stuff to them.
Right, right.
So
right.
Anyway, so I had made really good friends, kept in touch with them for years, a couple that I met there, Yvonne Menard and Mark Senning, later went to Channel Islands, but while they were in Hawaii, they wanted to get married at Sequoia National Park. So when I was there, I set it all up for them and found the place that they could legally get married, and they brought their own minister, so that was a lot of fun.
Can you spell their names, please?
Oh, yeah, Yvonne Menard, Yvonne, Menard, M-E-N-A-R-D, and Mark Senning, M-I-R-C, I think, S-E-N-N-I-N-G. And so, anyway, they were really great people. He was one of the many Marks, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Mark Danakis, there's Mark Senning, and on and on. And let's see, what else about the Arizona Memorial? I just took advantage of being there and going to all the islands, went scuba diving every chance, took the bus. That's what Hawaii calls their public transportation, the bus.
Okay.
To Ala Moana or to the zoo or something. And I really explored. I did something all of my free time and rode my bike where I could. There was a lot of hills. I realized after a while the bike wasn't the smartest thing to take unless I had like a little motor on it, because it was either uphill or downhill.
Oh, gosh. You mentioned this was the first time you had a chance to dive on wrecks, W-R-E-C-K-S.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was very cool because, you know, as a scuba diver since 1969, 1970 and so on, I've been diving in Catalina Island or off the coast of California, and at the time legally getting abalone and all that stuff. It was all natural history. It was all nature. But to actually go down and see a ship that had been, during World War II, that had been bombed, or a minesweeper or something like that, that was very special. And even since then, about five years ago, I think, in Hawaii off of Maui, I dove on a Douglas Dauntless, I'm saying that correctly, fighter plane that
wow.
somebody found. So I got to dive on the fighter plane more recently, not back then because I hadn't found it yet. So to see these things underwater and to see part of history and know how much was going on was very special. But it was also the time of the humpback whales, and it was just a whole other wonderful adventure to go to Hawaii and to get to know that area. And as a result, when Kent and I got together, we went there on our first year anniversary, and we've gone there every year since then for the most part. We've missed two or three years.
Wow.
We have a friend who's got a place on Maui, so we stay there for 2 weeks every year, except for COVID and a few other times.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So when I finished there, that's when I went to Santa Rosa to the Criminal Justice Training Center. And it was interesting because...
Nancy, I'm going to jump in here. You mentioned that you had a seasonal commission.
Yeah.
What's that?
When you are... you go to school and... Oh, one of the cool things that I did, I'm about to tell you that when I get to that. But
okay.
When you get a commission, let me put it, I have to correct myself because I didn't have my commission when I was at the Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
They had us do those walking through there, and I was thinking, maybe I need to do this.
Ah.
So that was part of the instigation for me doing that, because I was walking through looking for bad guys when I had no clue what I was looking for.
Got
it. I just spoke when I said I had it. This is one of the things that made me go get it.
Okay.
Plus wanting to continue to work in emergency medical services. And then I found out that people who are in protection are the ones who do search and rescue, and they're the ones who do firefighting and all this stuff. So it became as a wonderful adventure. I thought maybe I'd like to explore that part of being a park ranger.
Yeah.
But anyway, when you work for the National Park Service, you are given a very extensive background check and your fingerprints and making sure you're not a bad guy, and they go talk to your neighbors. And so if you are okie-dokied, then you are given a commission, which gives you the right to enforce the Code of Federal Regulations, and anything that is absorbed from the state laws that's not covered by the CFR. And as a seasonal, though, you are limited on what you can do. You cannot serve warrants. You can arrest, but you can't present in certain cases. You're limited in your abilities. When you become permanent, which I did years later, you are then sent to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glencoe, Georgia.
Okay.
GLYNCO. And there, that's a very, very, extensive, more than the 6-week classes. It's months and months and months of taking law classes and criminal investigations and interviewing techniques, and it's a police school, basically.
Got it.
And for land management agencies. But there, once you get a full commission, not a seasonal, but a full commission, then you can serve warrants, then you can do all kinds of things that you couldn't do as a seasonal, for instance.
Okay, so
the seasonal gets you in the door.
The Santa Rosa Training Center was, when you went through that training, you would then become a seasonal commissioned officer?
If I passed my background investigation.
Yeah.
If I passed and I was hired, I didn't have a commission unless I worked for the Park Service.
Okay.
So it's not like I'm walking around there with a seasonal commission. In the off season, when I worked as a paramedic, I had absolutely no power whatsoever.
Okay.
Your power is only in areas of the federal government that gives you the permission to do that.
Yeah.
Department of the Bureau of Land Management, National Parks, that kind of stuff. But the school was neat because it was held at the old juvenile facility in Santa Rosa up in the hills. And because we lived on campus and went to school on campus, my room was an old cell. So the door was like several inches thick. It made a big clunk when it closed.
Huh.
My bed was on chains hanging from the wall with a thin mattress.
Wow.
And I had a steel toilet in the corner.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we went to classes, and we had great ping pong tournaments, I remember. Great ping pong tournaments. But, we learned all kinds of stuff, how to handle a weapon.
Okay.
How to do search and rescue. But the thing that impressed me most was the was the constitutional law we learned.
Oh, wow.
I thought everybody in the country should go to this class just
yeah.
to learn the law of the country and how it works.
Yeah.
And to give you an example of the things that I learned is, if you were cold and you found a cabinet and you broke in to get warm, and on the way out you stole the stereo, okay, that is theft, breaking and entering and theft. If you looked in the window, saw the stereo, and broke in with the intent to take that stereo, that's burglary. The difference between a misdemeanor and a felony.
Wow.
So you learn the fine little things that go on, and it was really interesting to learn all of that.
Yeah.
But then we went to Sears Point over on the coast of California to the Bob Bondurant School of Driving.
Oh, wow.
And we learned how to drive patrol cars down slick oil so they can make them spin, and we could take them in and out of the spin, and how to drive and talk on the radio at the same time, and how to do a safe vehicle stop. I mean, it was, for a young person, it was just, everything was new and different and enriching.
Oh,
and I made lots of friends, and so it was very, very cool, and I thought at the time, and my mom thought it was very cool that I went to the Bob Bondurant School of Driving.
That, and this was like 6 weeks, the Santa Rosa.
Yeah. I think so.
Okay.
I think so. But the other thing is, on the weekends they had special classes for anyone who wanted to pay for it and go to it. So I took Firefighter 1 and learned my basic structural firefighting there. And on another couple of weekends I did high angle rescue.
Oh wow!
How to do ropes, how to tie ropes, and we went to the Russian River, and I did a Tyrolean traverse across the Russian River. We did all kinds of rope things and stuff. So it was the beginning of the athleticism in me and the desire to learn in me and wanting to do things that didn't take me away from natural history but enhance my life with these other skills.
Hmm. Okay. All right. That makes sense. Wow. That's very cool. That was just a month and a half, but a very packed in.
It was. And then, of course, every year you go to 40 hours of continuing education, and almost every day you're learning something new on the job. So that was
okay.
Cool.
Yeah.
So right after that ended, I started my many years of being a park medic instructor because I was already a paramedic, and I was working as a paramedic in the national parks. I'd worked in Sequoia and had the calls at the Arizona Memorial and Everglades. I was contacted by Valley Medical Center in Fresno and the National Park Service to become the skills instructor. So the park medics would not be paramedics. They had a much shorter time. They wouldn't be EMTs, but they could start IV, give a handful of drugs, and do an advanced airway. And so my job was to teach them the skills part, where the didactic or the school was taught by physicians.
Okay.
And every national park that has park medics has a liaison physician who's in charge of the programming. Usually they are residents, which are people who've graduated from medical school, and now they're learning how to become physicians in emergency medicine, and they all have to have special projects. So one of them is usually assigned as a park medic coordinator.
Okay.
And ours, the very first one, was a man named Ben Schifrin, Dr. Ben Schifrin, emergency medicine. And he's notable because he's one of the co-authors of the classic set of books on the Pacific Crest Trail.
Oh, wow.
Later on.
And his spelling, his last name?
S-C-H-I-F-R-I-N.
Thank you.
I believe. And so we worked together. We did that. And then when they would come up in the summertime when I would work at Sequoia National Park, they'd check in and they would do continuing education for the EMTs and all that kind of stuff. And then they'd go off on a hike. So it was win-win for them, for sure.
Fun. And so you were training people, I'm assuming, coming out of Yellowstone and coming out of, Crater
Grand
Lake
Teton,
and
Death Valley,
okay.
Yosemite, you bet. Anybody who wanted to have a park medic program. Not all national parks had a park medic program at the beginning.
Okay.
But after a while, they began to see the wisdom of it. And at Grand Canyon, there was, I think, one or two paramedics prior to my arrival that had been in the system. I showed up, and there were park medics and paramedics. And then after, I think I was there for 18 years or something, and then when I was done, they'd gone from park medics to paramedics at being park rangers. Still have some of those, but then they came and brought outside ambulance companies in to do a lot of the transport and some of the initial response. So it's gone through this great big cycle in time, I think.
Interesting. Yeah. So after the Santa Rosa Training Center, where did you go from there?
I became the park medic instructor at DMC in Fresno, and then I went to Sequoia National Park.
Okay, so when you were at Sequoia, this would be the summer of 83?
85.
Okay. So summer in 1985, that's right, because you'd gone to Everglades and then you'd gone to Hawaii.
Right, and then I went to Sequoia in 84 in the summer.
Right.
And then I went to Everglades, Sequoia, Arizona Memorial, Santa Rosa, Park Medic, and then now it's the summer of 85 where I worked as a naturalist and where they started calling me out as a paramedic now. And there was the district ranger was a man named Tom Scholl, T-S-C-H-O-H-L. And we had been friends for a while, and he'd used me occasionally as an EMT, but now that I had these skills, when they could call me, they did. And he eventually put a phone, one of those old black phones that you pick up, and it's your regular handset and everything.
Right.
I slept outside on a porch, out of choice, a screened-in porch. And so he had actually had a phone call so he can call me. But I was young, and I didn't care if they woke me up in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I think I already told the story of helping the person who got sick.
Yes.
Who was irritating
who
that
was
I got called
out. Poo-pooing the program.
Until until I helped her, and then she said, "We'll do whatever it takes."
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, that's
so
right.
So then I worked there, and then at the end of that summer in October, I worked till October, was my first big trip anywhere. And I grabbed my mom, and we went to Ireland to visit family.
Wow.
And that was very exciting because it was me taking my mom, my dad was really interested, to Ireland rather than my parents taking me somewhere.
Nice.
So I saved the money, and off we went, and we visited family, and we kissed the Blarney Stone, and we had such a grand time.
Wow. Nice.
And I've been back many, many, many times since then. Then when I came back, I worked that winter for Mobile Life Support, which is what used to be Modesto Series Ambulance.
Okay.
In from October of 85 until May of 86. And then from May to October, back to a naturalist paramedic Sequoia National Park.
Of 1986. So all that winter of 85, you continued to work on your skills as a paramedic,
right.
Getting those stronger. At that time, in the winter of 85, did you have a vision of where you wanted to take this, or were you just kind of going from seasonal to, you know, position to position? Did you have an idea where you were going yet?
I had no clue.
Okay.
I loved my life.
Mm-hmm.
I loved moving every 6 months, being challenged. I'm very fortunate to have a ability to remember things well.
Yeah.
And I am very adventurous. Bring it on. Anything new, I'm all for it.
Yes.
I'm a gregarious person who likes to be with people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's anything that allows me to be with people and to help people. It was really hitting all of the high points. But I had, at this point, you know, I'm very bring it on kind of a thing. And I always wanted to get married and have a family. That was always in the back of my mind. But I thought it would happen. You know, I'm not too worried about when it happens.
Right.
And until then, I am just going to play. So every 6 months, I did something different.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah.
And so you're on that track, but except you're anchoring back to Sequoia a lot.
Oh, Sequoia is my heart park.
Yeah, okay.
Sequoia is that's home.
Got it.
That's home.
Fun.
I went home every summer that I could.
All right. Makes
that's
sense.
Kind of the deal.
And you would have known the people there, and they would have known you. And
oh, yeah.
So it would have been
When you're seasonal, you have no expectation or right to come back. They don't have to bring you back.
Got it.
So you have an evaluation at the end of the season which says, highly recommended for rehire, recommended for rehire, forget about it. You know, you have different tiers that don't even think about it kind of stuff.
Right.
So it is behooves the one or two permanent people. And at that time, we had 15 to 17 seasonals at Sequoia National Park. That
wow.
was the golden era. Now they, I think, have three.
Wow.
But that is when it behooves them to bring it back. And I was, you know, one of the people that helped with the scheduling. And you can put me in, and I would help with the training of the new people. And they'd see you do a moral walk, geology talk, or follow you on Eagle View or Tharp's logs or your giant sequoia walk on the Congress Trail. And then being such a huge backpacker, you know, every weekend or days off, I would be off hitting the trails as soon as I got home.
Nice.
Man, I'd backpack on my back, and off I would go.
Okay. And that was the summer of 1986.
Yeah.
So were you thinking you were going to go back to work in the ambulance that winter?
No, I had another plan. My goal when I was in school as an undergraduate at UCLA I had met Jane Goodall.
Okay.
And I've had the great fortune of meeting her two other times since then.
Right.
And I always have been inspired. I think I told you about Doctari and things. And so I wanted to go to East Africa. And I had applied for a Fulbright scholarship, but I didn't get it as a student. And so I decided I'd save my money. And so my next big adventure was off to Africa for 4 months. And I went to Africa for 4 months, Kenya, Tanzania, Rwanda, Burundi. But we got kind of run out of Burundi because they were having a coup d'etat at the time. But
wow.
Other than that, so I went to Africa, and I spent 4 months in Africa, and it was the most wonderful time. I saw mountain gorillas. It was just right after Diane Fossey had been killed, so I was up in the Virunga Mountains, and I think I've already told that story of the gorilla that grabbed me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I got to go and see cheetahs and Ngorongoro and go to Masai Mara and have the best shower of my life out of an old butter can at Masai Mara. It was quite the wonderful adventure, and it just instilled in me that I really loved wildlife and I loved natural history and I loved to draw, and I would be drawing and all that kind of stuff. And then when I came back,
hang on, let's not go through there quite so fast. Did you kind of plan out where you were going to go? Did you rent a car? How did you travel?
No,
how did you work it out?
The first part I went was in Nairobi, and it was a set safari. And I had asked my friend Marianne if she wanted to go, and she didn't want to go. So
okay.
I was all set to go by myself. And like 3 weeks before we left, she goes, well, maybe I will go. Well, she had to run around and get her polio vaccination and all this other stuff done, but she joined me for 3 weeks.
Okay.
Then she went back, and to tell you what the era was at that time, I was collecting shields. I'm looking at them right now as I speak to you. I've got bows and arrows and masks and shield and all kinds of things that I had traded to the Maasai and the Samburu and the other peoples. And she was kind enough to take them home with me as carry.
Oh, wow. Great.
Things like that. So that was a nice thing for her.
Yeah.
To do. And then I got on a specific trip with a big truck that pulled a trailer. And there were 11 of us. And it was a set trip, but we were self-sufficient. We went to market. We learned as we went in and bought our food that you didn't buy any meat that was hanging because you would see the different maggots and you know it'd be there for a while.
Oh, yeah.
So we would pick out the animal we wanted and we'd watch it be killed.
Okay.
And then we would take the meat then.
Yeah.
But we would buy onions and stuff. And we traveled for months this way. And one of the ladies on the trip, Terry, she was a veterinarian, and I was only one of two Americans. There was Canadians, a great lady who was Dutch, another lady, two Britishers, and one of the Britishers was a veterinarian. And we were going through somewhere in Tanzania, and there was these big whistling thorn acacia trees.
Mm.
And the thorns are probably 2 to 3 inches long,
yeah.
All these little round balls. And they said, look over there, there's a Maasai giraffe. And I turned my head, and just as we went through an acacia tree, because we're high up in the truck, and it just sliced me right open from my upper lip all the way across my cheek. So
wow.
I got all this blood coming down my face, and so I'm doing direct pressure. And I said, who's got a mirror? And Terry said, well, I'll just sew you up. And I said, no, I'll just butterfly. You only work on dogs and cats. So I still have a little scar above my lip, but you can't see the one on the cheek anymore. But you could for a long time.
Wow.
But that was a trip that, you learned an awful lot about humanity, people, human beings. We always had somebody in the trailer at all times when we were stopped. And if we were in a city, we had two people because it was not unusual for somebody to distract the watcher. And then somebody would come up the other side to try to get belongings.
Oh, interesting. Huh.
And so when you went to market, there's always two people watching everything.
Okay.
And we stopped at Lake Victoria, and there was this big Nile perch. And a Nile perch is as big as a bed. So it's like 6 feet long and maybe 4 feet wide.
Wow.
This is one big, huge thing. And they bought it for the equivalent of an American nickel.
Oh, my gosh.
I was disgusted at the time when I found out how much they paid for it. And at that was when I stopped at eating seafood and fish and stuff. So they cooked it out on a grill, and I said, when they started cutting, I said, that doesn't look cooked very well, you guys.
Oops.
Oh, it's fine. Everybody but me was sick the next day.
Oops.
Everybody. I mean, I was bringing fluids to people. I was helping them with their diarrhea. It was just awful. Oh. I almost wish I had gotten sick so I didn't have to take care of 10 other people. But oh, well.
Right.
I never was sick. For 4 months, I was never sick, ever.
Gosh,
I just got sliced that one time.
Yeah.
And let's see. When I went to Virunga, let's see. And then, oh, we climbed Mount Kilimanjaro.
Oh, wow.
We went to the market. We got what we needed. And it was four gals. And a couple of guys decided they wanted to go, so there were seven of us. So it took 5 days, and you go up each night, and you stay at a hut, Kibo hut, and the different huts, because you're going up to 19,000 feet, so you want to acclimatize a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's got the most incredible trees. They look like something Dr. Seuss would draw. It was just amazing, and it was really great. And then we got to the point where we started to lose our appetite because of the beginning of altitude sickness.
Oh, okay.
We're hydrating as best we can. So at 15,500 feet, we're getting up at 1 o'clock in the morning to do our ascent to the top, which is going to be another 4,000 feet.
Yeah.
And turns out, and I never slept that night. I really tried to drink the tea, couldn't eat. I just had this pounding headache, but I was in an upper bunk and the ceiling was right above my head, so I really couldn't sit up. It was really awful. So I was awake most of the night, and then it turns out that it was a blizzard outside.
Oh, wow.
And I had specifically brought my down bag for this trip and my hiking boots and my down jacket. So I had all through Africa, I'd brought all this stuff with me and in a bag. And so I was bundled up. I was warm enough. I had my headlamp and flashlight. And we went outside, and it was probably only about mid-calf height at that point.
Okay.
But there was no trail.
Right.
Could not see the trail. And the guides, there were three guides, were guiding us with oil lanterns.
Wow.
And so here we're setting up on the trail. The wind is blowing. It's going sideways. Within 5 minutes, four people drop out. I mean, 5 minutes. They're puking their brains out. They're sitting in the snow. And one of them went back to get somebody to take them back. So it turns out there's just three of us left, and all three are ladies.
Okay.
And one Canadian, one Brit, and myself. And because there were three guides, the guides, I don't know if they thought did this on purpose, but they all took one of us, and we headed up at different paces.
Okay.
There was no trail to see, so what made it difficult is we went straight up the side of the friggin' mountain.
Mm.
And because there was no switchbacks to see, and I thought, this is awful. So I felt like I was on Mount Everest. I'd take three steps, and I'd stop and gasp and take three steps. And I would look at pictures in my mind of my family and thinking how much I love them and what the hell am I doing this for. But Arusha, and this is before Africa was really commercial, I bought a T-shirt in Arusha that was hand-painted. It said, I climb Mount Kilimanjaro. And I thought, if I don't do this, I can never wear that T-shirt. So halfway up, I stop in Hans Meyer's cave, which is a very famous cave. It's got icicles in it, named for some explorer some time ago. And the Chaga guide doesn't speak much English, but he goes, come on, mama. Come on, sister. You make it. You do it. Come on, mama. And I had, by this time, had given him my woolly cap because I had the hood on my jacket.
Mm.
He had tennis shoes on without socks.
Oh, gee.
I gave him my sweater, and I gave him a flashlight. He had nothing else on. He just had a windbreaker on.
Wow.
So it was just something. But he knew if he got me to the top, he would get, you know, nice things.
Yeah.
Money and stuff. So we made it to the top.
Wow.
And I showed him how to use my camera. And there I am in the blizzard, crouched down. And he took a picture of me with a sign, out Kilimanjaro, by my head. And here the snow was about mid-thigh thick.
Wow. But
by golly, we made it at sunrise. And as we started down, the other two, we could see across the crater. So we all got together, and it was like the Wizard of Oz. All of us linked our arms, the guides and the gals, and we went straight down the side of the mountains like going through a poppy field, just stepping and sliding and stepping and sliding in the snow and the cinders of the volcano underneath us.
Wow.
Picked up our stuff at 15,005 and went down to 12,000 feet and had the first thing I'd eaten in 2 days.
Wow.
Yeah, and then made our way out. But it was a very special time. And we we got back there, and then they taught us a song. Kilimanjaro, Kilimanjaro, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Anyways, we learned how to sing, and I gave him my headlamp, and I gave him extra batteries, and I gave him the watch cat, and I gave him socks, and I gave him money, and
cool.
He was right. I rewarded him for getting me up there.
Nice. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Huh. Very
so
cool.
That was, and then just getting out of Kenya was a trial. I don't know if you want to hear that story, but it is. It was very difficult getting out of the country.
And, why? Yeah.
Well, when I went to get to leave, I went to the single strip airport, and the building was closed. And I said, "Well, I'm supposed to fly out today. I've paid for this ahead of time." And they said, "Well, there's no flights today." I said, "Well, look at this." He goes, "Oh, that flight will be tomorrow." And I said, "Ah, but my visa expires tomorrow."
Oops.
"Well, you can't be here if you can't be in Tanzania." I said, "I know." And he said, "Well, maybe you can fly out Thursday." I said, "But my visa expires." So there was a bunch of people, a little market, cars, and I said, "Who's going to Kenya?" Mix of English and Swahili.
Hmm.
"Who's going to Kenya?" And this man with a kind of a Datsun wagon thing, "He's going to Kenya." And I said, "Are you going right now?" And he goes, "I'm going right now." I said, "How much to take me there?" And it was like $40.
Hmm.
I said, "Okay, here's $20 now, and the $20 when we cross the border." Because
hmm.
I'm not giving it all ahead of time.
Right.
And so he goes, "Oh, good. So I have my backpack." And so he takes the person in the front seat out of the front seat, which I feel really bad about, and puts me in the front seat with my backpack on my lap.
Hmm.
And that person gets squished in the back with the six other people that are already in the back there, women, children, all that kind of stuff. So I thought, ooh. So I had went out and I bought a stock of bananas. And I brought it back to the car, and I distribute the bananas to everybody. So that helped a lot. So off we went, and we're headed on this bumpiest road, and I don't know if we're, like, what we're doing, but we head in there, and then it's nighttime, it's dark, it's the car stops, we get going again, we stop at a checkpoint, he looks in at us, he waves us through, and then right before we get to the border, the muffler falls off.
Duh.
No problem. He picks it up, and he ties it to the top of the car. And we come into the border of Kenya and Tanzania sounding like something out of the Indy 500.
Yeah, yeah.
So I hand him the other $20 bill. I walk across the border with my backpack. And then the Kenyan police are there, immigration police. And I go into the thing and say, "You see, I've already come into Kenya, you know, and I'm back again." And they said, "Well, we can't have you come into Kenya." And I said, "Well, why not?" And he says, "Well, your papers are not all in orders." And so I walk outside. I thought, my papers are not in order. I take two $20 bills because there's two guys inside. I put the two $20 bills in the passport. I walk back inside. I said, "I found the paper that I was missing." I handed it to him. He goes, "Your paperwork is now in order."
Oh, wow.
Stamped my passport. I went out. There's loads of cars on the other side. It said, "Who will take me to Nairobi?"
Oh, my gosh.
So I get in a car. I think the muffler fell off on the way to Nairobi. I forget when that happened. But it was pretty fun. And then I get to Nairobi, and I stay at the hotel that I had a reservation for, and I get there half past dark 30. I don't know. But Africa was a whole other place, and I'm sure it still is.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
Very fun.
And then, let's see, where are we on time?
My next question for you is, where did you go from there? And let's talk about that next time.
Okay, yeah, I had a cousin living in London, so
oh.
I stayed with her on the way out, and I stayed with her on the way back.
Okay. And then where were you heading to on your way back?
Well, I also visited my family in Ireland.
Okay.
And then I came back and was a park medic instructor again. And then I worked for a company called Naturalist at Large, which is a fun place to stop and tell you about that.
Okay. And so this is 1987, is that right?
It is 1987.
Okay. That's where we will bring this back up again. Excellent. Is there anything else you want to bring into this before we wrap this up then?
No, but this has been such such a fun review of my life that I never expected when you asked me about this. I thought I was going to talk being a ranger at Grand Canyon, but what a fun
We're
review.
Getting there.
Thank
but,
you.
But when we get to Grand Canyon, we'll know that you spent 4 months in Africa. I mean, we would be amiss if we left that out. So this is great. And with that, this will conclude part four, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Nancy Eileen Malidi Meekum. Today is Wednesday, February 10th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. Nancy, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Tom.